If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, welcome into the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballengee, and it's good to have you here with us. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, or follow me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballengee. Our program is presented by Yahoo Sports. You can find my work at Yahoo Sports' Devil Ball Golf Blog, at sports.yahoo.com, as well as on thegolfnewsnet.com. If you're subscribed to the show, thank you so much for doing so. Please check out our live 24/7 stream of radio called Golf News Net Radio. It's available on our website, golfnewsnet.com, as well on the TuneIn Radio app. We have two podcasts for you this week. We actually have one that's a bit delayed, and that is an interview with Gary Player that was recorded on Wednesday ahead of his news conference at the 2015 U.S. Open at Chambers Bay in celebration of his 50th anniversary since he won the career Grand Slam in 1965 at Belgrave in the U.S. Open over Kel Nagel. And the conversation we didn't publish last week because my colleague at Yahoo Sports, Jay Busby, very similarly timed, had an interview with Gary Player in which he torched the golf course, said it was the worst he'd ever seen, and it really set off a firestorm of comments that really led the news cycle for the next 24 to 36 hours because he echoed those comments not only on the podcast but then on Golf Channel, and it just kind of became a bit of a mess, and the course almost more so became a story because of Gary Player's critical comments. However, when we spoke with him, he was much more nuanced, and by nuanced I mean he had no opinion at all because he hadn't seen the golf course yet. And so I'm very curious if Gary Player actually saw the golf course, and if he did, what kind of opinion change that had on him and how long he spent out there. Because as we'll get to in this second podcast of the week, which more of a comprehensive review of the U.S. Open from a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different facets, I think you find it be really challenging for Gary Player, much less anybody else, to get around Chambers Bay and see enough of it to form a true opinion about the architectural character of the golf course and its quality from the Robert Trent Jones Jr. design. I just think you'd be hard-pressed to figure it out. You can't really from TV, and we'll get to that. But there was an interesting tweet brought to my attention this morning, which is dated 6/17, and Gary Player was asked by a Twitter follower, so that's the Wednesday, so that's right around that time. And he was asked about his opinion of the golf course. And in response, he said, "I like it, but other players will not." So very quickly, he changed his tune and said it's the worst thing he's ever seen. And so I want to lead with that because I think if you listen to the podcast with Gary, I think that he's got more of a principal problem with the way that the USGA set up Chambers Bay than the golf course itself. And I say that because he was downright indignant at the way the USGA has treated golf, the way it views golf, the way it sets kind of a poor example for the sport in times in his view. And so if you listen to the podcast, and we'll put these both on iTunes and Audio Boom today, so you can listen to them hopefully concurrently, but whenever you have time, I think you'll see and hear from Gary Player a lot more nuance than other just spitting, you know, foaming at the mouth anger at Robert Trent Jones Jr. Really, it's anger at the USGA. And I think that was somewhat warranted. I think that's where we have to lead. Is was Chambers Bay a good venue, and was the course setup ultimately a good one? And I think that Chambers Bay is a wonderful golf course. I cannot tell you how much I think I would enjoy playing it as its normal green self, because it's not always brown there. I mean, if you look at, and it became starkly apparent what was B-roll and what was footage from that week, because the B-roll footage that typically the USGA organizes for media to shoot during the media day, which is either several months prior, or they sometimes have a preview day almost a year prior to the championship. The footage looks great. I mean, it looks incredible. It's green. It's everything you want it to be in terms of a faux American Lynx golf course. and it just looks like a ton of fun to play. And then you see it in person for the U.S. Open, and you're like, whoa, that's kind of ridiculous. And really, I think the only issue with Chambers Bay as a golf course, there are some holes that are somewhat repetitive. If you look at 7 and 13, they're very much the same hole. The 7th hole has a little bit more drama in terms of an uphill second shot, but the routing is the same, left to right, you got to get around a bunker. God forbid if you go right, you're dead off the tee shot, but the generous room. You see that shot a lot at this golf course, a lot of right-to-left favored golf shots, which I think is kind of lame. You need to be able to favor left-to-right and right-to-left. But the ones favored left-to-right from 13 and 7. And, you know, you see some repetitiveness, but that's fine. But the finish was wonderful. I think you have to love 15, 16, 17, and 18. 16 is a drivable par 4 if you play it inside of 400 yards and you can hit it almost 300 yards with that U.S. Open setup. I think that's brilliant. I think that entertains so much more drama than reducing a 370-yard hole or a 400-yard hole to a 269-yard hole, which was one of those experiments Mike Davis did. He did the 08 U.S. Open at Torrey Pines, and I don't think it made sense then to make it essentially par 3 length and call it a par 4, even though you really couldn't get to the green. It was a lie. It was basically a lie. But the drivable par 4, on Sunday at least, was not a lie. Guys were able to hold the green because at 330-some-odd yards, you could hit a 3-wood pretty strong, run it up, and it might hold the front of the green. It might even hold the green itself because it'll land a little bit softer than driver the day before from like 380 yards, where the only real play was be Dustin Johnson long and draw it in just slightly over the edge of the right bunker that runs up the length of the hole. And that was really the only play. 17 was a good hole. I think there are a limited number of hole positions there, especially because there's a huge ridge on the right, and there's no—I mean, you literally can't use it as a golf hole. If you did, you would never be able to play to it. You wouldn't be able to make birdie unless you sank a 50-foot uphill swinging left to right putt. Make no sense at all. So I think the USGA in that regard was limited in hole positions, but the concept of 17 tee to green is a very good one. And then 18 is a 5, I think, is very, very enjoyable. It is a tight line to get to the fairway and hold it with a driver in your hand. I know Jordan Spieth complained about 100 yards up with an even tighter driving area, but it's a tight squeeze there over on the left because you can put it in the fairway bunker on the left. If you miss to the right and you don't hit it long enough, you're going to be you're going to hit a bunker shot out and lay up and bring in the Chambers basement, that monstrosity of a bunker that should be just fill it in. And if you're Dustin Johnson long, you can take all the trouble out of play and just blast it and leave a min iron in there, seven to five iron somewhere in there, which is basically what he did. And the green complexes, at 18, I thought made a whole lot of sense, except if you missed to the right short side of yourself, like Rory McIlroy did on Sunday's round or Saturday's round, I forget which. And the result was he just splashed it out barely under the grass, not even the putting surfaces that were dotted with white paint, and he found himself leaving a 50-foot putt to 2-putt for par, which I understand if you short side yourself in a green on a par 5 or any hole for that matter, you should be in some sense of danger, but you should also not be forced to hit barely over from out of the sand into the grass and then not be rewarded for that kind of petite execution, I think. But overall, I liked the golf course. The fan experience, I hated. Because, you cannot convince me, if you were a fan, you're there, that you had the best time you possibly could. You may have had a good time, especially if you're on a Sunday. If you sat in the grandstands on 15, 16, 17, and 18 on Sunday, you got a hell of a show. Because we have one of the better U.S. Opens in recent memory, if not all time, because of the quality of the characters that were chasing and the quality of the finish in terms of drama, if not quality of play. And I think that beyond those grandstands, which often had lines 50 deep, sometimes 100 deep to get into them, the experience stunk. It was just terrible. And that's because the mounding is so high, it's so dramatic that as a golf course, from an aesthetic standpoint, is gorgeous, it's wonderful. From a fan standpoint, it ruins everything. Because there are only so many holes that you can see. You can see some of one. You can see some of 18. Can't see all of either because of the way that they were kind of stadiumed in a little bit, that they're a bit of a punch bowl into themselves, especially with the grandstands over on 18. And you can't go up the fairway of 1 and 18 because they share space. And the mounding on 1 is just obscene in terms of trying to create an angle there. So you're really looking basically down at an ant in the fairway. And it just kind of carries on like that throughout the course where there were, I mean, 2 was a great hole, 3 was a good hole to watch, 4 was modest, but you can't really go up the right side. 5 is a similar concept coming back down, can't go on the left side. So, I mean, they're just entire portions of holes that were locked out of fans. And so walking inside the ropes with these guys over the course of 4 days, you could tell they weren't really able to draw on the crowd very much because they weren't really there. I mean, literally on the 8th hole, no one could be on the fairways because the side hill to the right, if you miss way right, like where Tiger Woods missed it, you had to miss another 20 yards to the right to hit a fan, at least, down the hill. So there's no way fans would ever be able to climb up that steep a hill to watch the hole, and they set it up that way for safety purposes, obviously, but it created a really weird lull in the round where you just are kind of just playing a hole. And on a par 5, as a professional golfer, you're typically expecting fans to be around to provide you with some kind of context clue about how good your shot was, especially when you're coming in to a par 5 as long as that, where you're hitting from 270, 280, you got to roll it up, you're dependent on the bounces, and you just have no audio to tell you whether you hit a good shot or a bad shot. It's a really strange part of the round. 9, I thought, worked out really well. That was the best use of the grandstand other than 18. And I think that 12 was a cool spot because you had one grandstand, basically where it was a drivable par 4, so that's all people really needed to see was the greenside complex. So in that regard, that was a hit. The 13th grandstand was incredible. It was probably the best place to be on the course in terms of view. Not the best hole. I didn't find it all that interesting of a hole, but in terms of view, because you get to see 13 green, you get to see 14 tee and green. You got a beautiful view of Puget Sound. You got to somewhat get a sense of what was happening at 12, even though you couldn't see it. I think that was probably one of the better parts of the course. But walking around the course is exhausting. I mean, it's a tough walk if you're just playing it. It's an even tougher walk as a spectator because of how out of the way you've got to go to get to some of these holes, because you can't walk direct to them. I mean, even the players couldn't do that. So it was a tough slog, and you could tell people were pretty well exhausted early in the day, and it lost a lot of mojo. So I think from a fan experience standpoint, if you're going to come back to Chambers Bay, you've got to do some serious alterations to the mounding. You've got to kind of dull it down quite a bit to make some of the holes more accessible so that in some cases a fan could literally just stumble upon action and enjoy it, and that there could be more fans that are closer to that action. I think that would be a better fan experience overall. But I thought the setup was fine. I think the fatal error in terms of setup was trying to play these greens at 11.5 to 12 on the stimp meter, when really fescue is engineered for 8 to 9 on the stimp. And it can be brown or it can be green, but as Mike Davis explained somewhat presciently leading into the week on Wednesday during his news conference, he said fescue blades of grass, and this is nerd speak, get thinner through the course of the day. That's why they speed up, because it's not as thick. There's not as much tack to them. So all of a sudden they get a little bit quicker. But the blades thin, which means the surface area that those blades of grass cover gets reduced. And it's in those gaps that you get the wobbles that you probably saw pretty often if you saw a close-up shot of putts on TV, although Fox didn't do a whole lot of that. And that's also where the spaces where the POA is and some bent grass, but predominantly where the POA was, fills in, takes over, and creates even more bumpiness and inconsistency in speed. So you saw obviously lots of bumps, lots of guys complaining. They played it too fast, too firm, too dry. Obviously they expected some rain, but this is a record drought, so there's somewhat of a hedging here in my kind of fiery response. Because they could have killed it. I mean, they really could have killed all of the greens, and they would have been putting on dirt. And in some spots, they were actually putting on, went dirt or darn close to it. Jordan Spieth on Saturday hit his shot into four green, and it was a good shot, and he had basically no chance to get to the ball of the hole because he couldn't judge putting through dirt. And that's a darn shame. I'm glad he won in the end, but that's a shame. And Billy Horschel had it right. The USGA's tactics, I think, somewhat mitigated putting skill. You saw it from Jordan Spieth, who had 6 3 putts over the course of the week. That is very unlike Jordan Spieth. He's the best lag putter in the world. He is the best putter in the world. So for him, this should have been an opportunity to run away with him, with how generous the fairways were. I mean, the guys were hitting 70% of the fairways. You would have to hit a terrible tee shot or overreach to go over trouble to hit a bad tee shot and miss the fairway. I think that they could have gotten there with some more consistency on the greens had they replanted all the greens at the same time. Greens like number 7, I believe 13 was replanted. Both those were good greens, and that's because they were replanted. They've had trouble growing fescue on this course, even though it is a grass-type friendly to this environment up in Washington State. But for whatever reason, they've had trouble growing it, and they've had trouble keeping POA out. So they've redone a couple of them, and they did a redo of several greens after the 2010 U.S. Amateur. Those greens were good. Those were pretty consistent over the course of the week in terms of speed, quality, all that stuff. Every one of the other ones, not so great. And that was kind of the mistake. They should have just redone all 18 and been on the same page, same schedule. And I feel like this is another example of a greens project that has doomed a U.S. Open or a U.S. Open venue. Because Congressional, which had the opportunity to host the 2010 Amateur, was going to host the 2010. It did host the 2010 U.S. Open. They undertook a green project that failed miserably. And that's why they couldn't do the 2010 Amateur. That's why Chambers got it, because they had a last-minute gap to fill, and this new course is willing to take on the task. And by the time they redid it at Congressional, the greens had barely been growing at all. They'd been there a year. They need at least 2 years, maybe 3 years, to grow in properly. They had a bad summer, and they lost them. Or, in case of trying not to lose them, they had to slow them down to the point that it was basically like your regular PGA Tour event where you could just fly to flags and greens were fairly soft. That's why Rory McIlroy lit it up at Congressional. Same thing happened here, except they didn't heed the advice and slow them down. They stuck with the plan in the face of the drought. And I think that really doomed them, and that led to all the complaining and whining. And I think Billy Horschel was right. I mean, I heard a lot of grumbling inside the ropes about this golf course, particularly about the greens. Tiger Woods complained about the sight lines and the lines off the tee, which were bogus. I mean, it's just hit in the middle of the fairway, dummy. But the greens, I think, were a legitimate beef, and some guys chose to speak up and others didn't. I think Jordan Spieth would have spoken up had he played poorly, but I think he just complained about the architecture of 18 to kind of prove a point. And for those of you that think that Mike Davis changed 18 into a par 5 on Sunday to appease Jordan Spieth, you are absolutely wrong. Nothing to do with it. It's just wind. That's all it was. That was his decision point, Mike Davis's, all weekend. Where was the wind blowing? Where was the prevailing wind? And would it make sense for it to play as a par 5 or as a par 4? Play it a little downwind? Play it as a par 4. Or play as a par... Yeah, play as a par 4. Plays into the wind, you got to play as a 5. That's what they did. And, you know, I think that was the right call there. So overall, and I know I had several people come to me on Twitter and ask, well, why don't they plant POA and be like Pebble? Well, first of all, POA sucks. No one really wants POA. The only place on Earth that really can handle POA well is a place like Pebble that has more marine layer, has more marine influence than Chambers Bay. And even then, toward the end of the day, it gets really bumpy as well, which is something people tend to forget. It gets actually slower over the course of the day, so you have to water it even less, which means you run the risk of killing it even more. It's a dangerous grass to bring into play. And you say, well, bring in bent. Nope, same problem. It winterizes well, which means you probably have temp greens less at Chambers Bay, and they had them for 6 months last year. But it also means that you're subject to winter kill. I just don't think that makes much sense either. Thrives in warm weather, which really we got, but it's not supposed to be there, so it doesn't make sense as a good grass, even though it is predominant in like an area like Chicago. But Chicago gets hot in the summer. It can be 90 degrees, bent holds on. It's not really ever going to be 90 degrees. I mean, we got it as warm as we were going to get it at Chambers, and I think that kind of threw things off too. So a whole lot of factors there at play as to why the setup wasn't that great, the fan experience wasn't that great. But then despite all of that, we get the showdown we want. We get a great champion, Jordan Spieth. We get a kid at 21, about to turn 22, who was halfway to the single-season Grand Slam, going to a course in St. Andrews that actually rewards good putting and will allow him to use his Texas brand of golf to thrive. I think Rory McIlroy will put up a great fight and may well dominate at St. Andrews. He loves playing that course. He has a tournament 63 there in the Open Championship in 2010, so he knows how to do it. But I think it's going to be a fascinating venue to see how McIlroy tries to dominate and get back what he almost thought he had on the final day, where he was chasing 63, maybe 62, which that was a product of the setup. The fairways were wide, the greens were somewhat softened, and they were a little bit more consistent because they were softer, so that allowed guys to make putts of more length. I mean, that's why Rory can make a 72-foot putt. That's why Patrick Reed made a 30-foot putt in the round. That's why those things happened, because they had to change the setup to create scoring opportunities where putts could actually go in the hole as opposed to just wobble their way around it. So yeah, I think that was a nice treat by Mike Davis. The final round scoring average at the U.S. Open was like 71.29, which is the lowest in the history of the U.S. Open. So you can't tell me that those guys try to protect par too much, because they think they realize the error of their ways, and they like, I mean, Mike Davis likes a dramatic Sunday to begin with, but he didn't create a situation where it was going to be really hard to score. He created a situation where if you just kept hitting greens, you probably were going to eventually score, and it worked. So as we move on, we've got a guy chasing the career Grand Slam, in part because of this venue, in part because Dustin Johnson can't putt very well, and in part because he didn't give it enough speed to try and get it in the hole. Now, let's go to that 12-foot putt. That was a tough read, and I went out there after the fact for the 4-foot comebacker. That was a right-edge putt. It didn't seem that easy standing over. It seemed like something you might crap your pants over if you had it for the U.S. Open. And we won. You could easily get overly aggressive, where you're trying to just smash it in the middle. There's break there, and I think he just tried to smash it in and kind of pulled it a little bit, misread it a little bit, and that was it. 3-putt par to lose the U.S. Open is a kind of strange way to lose, where par is a great score at the U.S. Open, except when you need birdie or when you need eagle. And that's a tough one to watch. But I think Dustin Johnson is, I'll say this nicely, resilient enough that despite having blown it in 4 major championships, including 2 U.S. Opens on the West Coast, on somewhat similar tracks, I guess, in terms of their geography, I still think he's got... I mean, think about that. Dustin Johnson has had four opportunities to win majors on links-style golf courses. Because Whistling Straits is a links style course, albeit not a pure links, it's a faux links. Pebble Beach is a faux links. Chambers Bay is a faux links. You could argue Royal St. George's is a faux links. So that's an interesting thing to think about in future major championships. If for whatever reason, Dustin Johnson does thrive in them, probably because the fairways are bigger and the greens are typically not fast, and so those appeal to his strengths. So think about that for the Open Championship, and think about that for Whistling Straits. Remember those things. Okay, so let's turn our attention very briefly, and we'll speak about this for maybe the remainder of the show, about Fox, about their telecast. I obviously did not catch too much of this, so this is not a very limited sample size, because I caught a lot of it on Sunday, but it is on a fairly limited sample size compared to the number of hours that the network aired of the U.S. Open. But there was a lot of talk in the media center and a lot of talk among people in town about the Fox broadcast and the kind of job that they were doing. And I think it's easy and cliche to say they just suck. I think there's more nuance to it than that. I think that a lot of verbal things failed, and I think a lot of visual things weren't used to their maximum potential. Joe Buck as an anchor just did not do well. He tried to give a football and baseball mentality to a sport that needs a little bit more, I won't say reverence, I think that's the wrong word, but I think it needs a little bit more explaining, it needs a little bit more scene setting. And Buck just seemed to refuse to do that. Greg Norman was perfectly adequate in the role, but didn't stand out because he swallowed his mic too much. In big moments, he didn't have a whole lot to say. And that's where you need to be, not your most verbose, but your most powerful, most potent. And he just seemed to want to rely on silence and cliche. And I think that made people somewhat long for Johnny Miller, who would tell you how to hit the shot, how he'd hit the shot, whether it was a choke job or not, all of those things. And that's probably too far for some people. But given the choice, I want more information than less. I'd rather think you speak too much than not know you're even there. And that was kind of the big issue with the 18 Tower team. And they really weren't an 18 Tower team in the pure sense, but Holly Saunders struggled, very much struggled in that spotlight. And I think that is probably why you haven't seen her too much in the three USGA events that Fox has aired so far. They have the US Senior Open this weekend, too. I think that tells you a little bit of something about where this stands, you know. Where she stands as a broadcaster. The interviews were just awkward. The Phil Mickelson hug is inexcusable. That should never air on television. That's part production. That's part Holly. The interviews with players where she basically asked them about other players' action, I thought, seemed to demean those players as mere bystanders or witnesses to other things that were happening. I thought that was unfortunate. You could tell the players were kind of like, well, what about me? Even though they may not necessarily have played championship winning golf, they played championship relevant golf. I think Kevin Kistner and Ernie Els come to mind in those cases, and I don't think that was very good. Charles Davis was even worse in that capacity, and that's to say that there is not the best track record of solid post-round interviews. You often get an awkward one for whatever reason. You typically either don't get a good question or you get a question that's too awkward. You don't find a lot of folks who can ride the middle there. So I'm not incredibly upset about those two, Saunders and Davis. Davis should not be back. But I think that it is important enough to provide color to the telecast that they need to be there and they need to be able to ask relevant, timely questions, not just golf dumb questions. And I think that happened far too often. If you look at some of the announcers, I think some are good, some are bad. You know, Brad Faxon was great, Corey Pavin was boring. Steve Flesh does a good job of describing things. Julie Inkster, for all of her knowledge, seems to disappear, kind of like Greg Norman. When she does say something, it's not as insightful as you think someone with her experience, her championship experience, especially in the USGA, might have. Natalie Galbis, same thing. You would think she has some good experience and could draw upon it. It could be a really kind of friendly, bubbly, interesting voice, and that just didn't bear out that way. Jay Delsing, I think, stepped in someone's line, Rory McIlroy's line. Watch, I mean, that's, or his ball or something. But that was not good. Kurt Menefee, just stop. Don't come back. Shouldn't be invited back. Don't coach him up. Go find somebody that has broadcast golf before as a host, or eliminate the position altogether. Whatever you got to do, but that needs to go away. Tom Weisskopf, go away. You're just not interested enough in the circumstances to make a relevant voice for a golf tournament in 2015. You're good as like a one-time experiment for the Open Championship, where you can almost kind of get away with it the way ESPN does it, but not the way Fox does it. So you need to stop that. But the production value, I thought overall, was pretty okay. I mean, there are definite misses. They didn't have the announcers tell you hole, club, and distance, and shot often enough. So they tried to use that with graphics that laid on too long, but I was kind of okay with that. The omnipresent leaderboard was not a bad idea, just it was too rigid, so when there were more than one guy in the fifth position on the leaderboard, you're tied for fourth, tied for third, whatever, that wasn't able to accommodate the number of names that it needed to accommodate, maybe up to 8 or 10 at one point. I thought that was a bit of a miss. They relied on ProTracer too much, but I really like ProTracer. So I think if they use it in tandem with being able to actually find the ball with the camera and maybe not use it to its logical end, all the way to the end of the shot, but use it 3/4 of the way through the shot, I think that's going to be really great to trail with the ball at Oakmont. I think that'll be a very good piece of technology. I think they use some of the toys less than they could have. The drone camera, who cares? The camera that slides back and forth, who cares? The mics, I thought the mics were wonderful. Having them in the cup, that picked up Spieth at a critical time with Greller. It picked up the conversation where he called 18th the dumbest hole. I thought that was very good, and that's the kind of insight you really want. I mean, so often when you watch NBC and CBS, you see people say, just let those guys talk. Let the players tell you the story. Don't talk over them. And when you're privy to those conversations in moments, you really understand what the stress of tournament golf is like. So kudos on that. That was great. Fox will figure out how to get better at this. This was a very tough first run. C-minus kind of material. It could have been even worse. And they had a difficult first venue to work with, Chambers Bay. I stood 5 feet from so many golfers this week inside the ropes, watching them hit ball after ball in competition, and I had a hard time finding the ball at times. So it's very difficult for a cameraman of any angle, of any kind of power of zoom, to find the ball. So that explains that a little bit, that aesthetic, that problem where you're often just like, where'd the ball go? That's why. It was pretty much anyone that didn't hit the shot themselves had a hard time seeing where the ball went. So I think, again, you're going to see a really revamped Fox lineup next year. I would not be surprised if a couple of folks who did the digital coverage, namely a guy, Shane Bacon, who did a nice job calling holes, four ball, the women's four ball at least. I think he did a good job on the digital coverage. He continues to improve as a guy who covers play-by-play. He's not going to be Joe Buck, and he's not going to lead the coverage or anything like that anytime soon. But he certainly has the capacity to be another voice that you could have call the 15th hole, or the 16th hole, or the 17th hole, whatever you need to decide to have those hole announcers. He could be a very good one, a good scene setter. He has a very good voice for television. He has a good way of setting scene verbally speaking. So I think he's got a good future there. Robert Dameron was very good in his role as the foil, the sidekick for Shane. I think he should be called up to the main telecast for next year. And then beyond that, go hire the guys that call SiriusXM, that do the PGA Tour on a week-to-week basis. Bring in Brian Kadrick. Bring in John McGinnis. Bring in Fred Albers. Doug Bell. Bring in those guys. Coach them up to do it for TV. It's not that big of a transition. And you'll have a much better broadcast with names people recognize and voices they understand, getting the situations right, and adding the proper color to the good mix of technology that Fox already uses. That all said, we had a hell of an Open. It was a lot of fun for me to go cover it. As I mentioned on Twitter, I have not covered a U.S. Open or a major championship in person in 4 years. Last one was the 2011 PGA, so that was a heck of a finish too with Keegan Bradley. And I've had the good fortune to cover majors typically that have pretty cool finishes. 2011 was just awesome for interesting majors for one reason or another. Charles Schwartzel made 4 birdies to win the Masters. Rory McIlroy obliterated the field in Congressional to win a U.S. Open just after giving away the Masters. I didn't cover the Open Championship that year, but then you have Keegan Bradley at the PGA. And from a personal standpoint, going from Golf Channel, the Back Nine Network, to other places you probably haven't heard of, and to be fortunate enough to join up with Yahoo Sports almost a year ago, and for them to give me the opportunity to go cover a major championship again, it really brought out a lot of pride, and I hope you saw that in my work this week, because I I felt really inspired by the opportunity, and obviously the drama helped make things speak for themselves a little bit easier. So thank you for those of you that read. Thank you for those of you that follow me on Twitter. And thanks for subscribing to this show. As I mentioned, we have a second show this week. It'll go up basically concurrent with this one, where we'll talk about our conversation with Gary Player and air that for you as it happened last Wednesday. And we'll let you judge for yourself if maybe he seems as maniacal, as frothing at the mouth as he did later that day and throughout the course of the week talking about Chambers Bay. Until next time, I'm Ryan Valenti saying thank you for listening. We'll catch you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.